We're going to open the floor to a few questions. Thank you again, Chris, for that lovely presentation.
Hi, Tim Carman, affiliated with Warrior Writers and Veterans for Peace, and other local folks. And I'm a comic book fan from my childhood, and it was always such a powerful conduit in my life. I know it's something that changed me drastically as an independent comic book. Most folks wouldn't even take a fright, but it was sort of storyline in a comic book. And I'm wondering why you chose the graphic novel form, or whatever you choose to call it. I love that you did. I'm just wondering what the thought process was behind that.
Well, it's a mixture, of course. 50 pages in the book are by Joe. And I met Joe in Bosnia when he was doing his book, The Raja, Safe Area. And I was not a reader of graphic novels, and watched him work. And Joe's an incredible journalist who draws out his narrative, which gives it a resonance and a kind of power. He's an amazing reporter. And it's funny because when he began, graphic novelists didn't know what to do with him, and journalists didn't know what to do with him. You can do things through panels that you can't do even through photography. You can go back in past. So for instance, we interview a miner, a 91-year-old miner, Rudy, who began working in the mines like many young teenagers after his father was killed in a mine accident. Before it was unionized, before it was mechanized, never leaves West Virginia except to go to World War II, where he's wounded in the Battle of the Bulge. When we saw him, he was dying of black lung. When you spend long amounts of time in the coal mines, you'd get black lung. And Joe really was able to go all the way back, and he would research what the equipment were in the mines in 1937 when Rudy began, and draw out his life. So it gives you almost a cinematic quality. And I wanted a visual component to the book, and you know, loosely the book was modeled on Agee's Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, Walker Evans doing the photography, because we have rendered the poor in this country invisible. The only time they ever appear in terms of popular culture is when they go on reality shows or Jerry Springer or something, and we ridicule them. And I wanted people to see their dignity, their struggle. You know, as Barbara Ehrenreich correctly points out, being poor in America is one long emergency. And I think it's quite frightening as a reporter the way we have erased virtually half the country and the desperate struggle that has enveloped these lives. And, of course, the effects, once again, on children. That, you know, most of the recipients of food stamps are children. And yet, you know, we are living in a corporate state which actually cuts food stamps. So that was why. And he's also just, it was a two-year process. We traveled all over the country, and he's incredibly literate and incredibly funny, and and we're close friends, and so it, you know, writing books can be very lonely endeavors, and he saved me from losing my driver's license, because I've calmed down now, but spending 20 years in a war zone, you don't really think much about traffic lights or anything, and so I drive too fast, and actually got too many points and had to go to one of those classes where they show you a video. I was sort of quite proud of myself for being a criminal. And I turned to the guy next to me and said, "What are you here for?" And he said, "Well, it was 2 in the morning and I was going down I-95 at 140 miles an hour on my cycle without a helmet." So that was kind of... And the other guy had tried to outrun a cop on his motorcycle. And the guy next to me said, "Dude, man, you're supposed to hide the cycle when you get..." Anyway. traffic, it was just long empty roads. I was cruising down the road at 80 miles an hour, and a cop went by this way. And I looked in the rear view mirror and saw him do a U-turn. And so I gunned it for the next hill, got down and jumped out and said, "Joe, get in the driver's seat really quick." He said, "I've never had a ticket." I said, "That's exactly why you're getting in."
To the economic crisis. A rational response to
the upsurge of protests and occupying encampments by the state would have been a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions, a forgiveness of all student debt, a massive jobs program, especially targeted at people under the age of 25, and a rational, universal health care system as a right for all citizens. That would have been rational. The state didn't respond rationally. The state responded through force. They expended, through the organs of state security, tremendous resources into monitoring and persecuting the movement. I was at Cecily McMillan's trial in New York. She's now in Rikers. What they do is they, because the movement was so dependent on social media and electronic forms of communication, which they all download, the state has, they know who to go after, and they have been going after them. And what they do is they stack charges against them, as they did with Cecily or another friend of mine, and they give them a felony charge, and they force them to plea out. All of the charges are spurious, if not completely untrue, but they force them to plea out, but they leave that. That means it's a five-year probation with a felony charge, and they're heavily circumscribed in terms of what they can do, because if they're arrested again, then they go to jail. So that was the response of the state. And because the state didn't respond rationally, and because there are no now internal limits in terms of the predatory nature of corporate capitalism, it means that they will push and push and push until there is blowback. It is always the ruling class that determines the configuration of revolt. And because of the insidious nature of our corporate ruling elite, I can guarantee you, and I speak as somebody who covered all the revolutions in Eastern Europe, the two Palestinian uprisings, the street demonstrations that brought down Slobodan Milosevic, something's coming. What it will be called, what will ignite it, no one knows. I was in East Germany covering the movement out of Leipzig, and of course, that was begun by mostly Lutheran pastors and congregants who were holding very sparsely attended candlelit vigils every week to protest the Honecker regime. Erich Honecker had been in power for 19 years, and suddenly something ignited. 90,000 people, 70,000 people started marching in Leipzig, and Erich Honecker sent down an elite paratroop division to fire on the crowd, and they refused. And Honecker lasted another week in power. I was in Leipzig with the leaders of that movement on November 9th, 1989, in the afternoon. And those leaders said, maybe within a year, we will have free passage back and forth across the Berlin Wall. By that evening, the Berlin Wall, as an impediment to human traffic, did not exist. Now, that was a very important lesson for me, because it showed that even those who are the purported leaders of the movement don't actually understand or know where it's going, what the dynamic is. So something will come, whether it will be called Occupy, what it will look like, what will ignite it, none of us know. But then something is coming, I have no doubt. And when it comes, I will be there.
But as a student activist, I'm having a lot of problems getting people to
not only been deeply betrayed by my generation, but lied to. And one of the greatest purveyors of those lies are the academic institutions where you study. Because they are not telling you what it's like out there. They are piling debt upon you. Massive amounts of debt. Debt that you can never get out of, as you know. Even if you declare bankruptcy, it will just accrue interest forever. And I think one of the triggers of the Occupy movement were what Bakunin called déclassé intellectuals. These are the sons and daughters of the middle class who expected, after getting a university of education, to be integrated into the system of power in some way. And people are graduating from institutions like BU, and they're not being integrated into those systems. And they are burdened in a form of debt peonage. Debt peonage has always been a mechanism for political control. It's how African Americans have been controlled since emancipation. And so at that moment, you begin to ask other questions. Within the university itself, I think this passivity or what you're talking about is because people imbibe in this kind of fiction that, and this is just fed to us across the political and cultural spectrum, that reality is never an impediment to what we desire. We can have everything we want if we just follow our dreams and work hard. Obama gives this talk all the time. But so does the Christian right, so do positive psychologists, so does Oprah, so does Hollywood. And it's a kind of infantilism where you never grow up. You never face reality. And finally, when reality confronts you, especially in its bleakness, oftentimes because you don't understand systems of power, you react as children react, which is to look for a demagogue or a savior or a charismatic leader. I was just in Alabama, in Montgomery, with the great death row lawyer Brian Stevenson, one of, you know, the heroes of American society, has dedicated his life to poor people on death row. And we were walking through Montgomery, and it was one Confederate memorial after another, Brian's block. And Brian said, you know, this, all of these have been put up in the last 10 years. You go into Montgomery, and it's one of those gigantic Confederate flags. Half of Montgomery's black. It's where King had his first church. Giant flag. They had just held a reenactment of Jefferson Davis's inaugural, where a bunch of white guys dressed up like Confederate soldiers and some guy dressed up like Jefferson Davis in a carriage had gone through the center of Montgomery and been inaugurated. Montgomery was the first Southern White House before it was moved, on the steps of the state capitol. And I told Brian that reminded me of the breakdown of Yugoslavia. That when societies push people out into states of economic desperation, as happened in Yugoslavia, the ethnic war in Yugoslavia was not caused by ancient ethnic hatreds, it was caused by the economic collapse of Yugoslavia and hyperinflation. They cling to a kind of mythical past. And that surge of neo-Confederacy throughout the South is very similar to the surge of ethnic nationalism that I saw with the breakdown of Yugoslavia, and has very frightening ramifications, because at that point you have groups that no longer speak the language, because they're not talking about reality, they're not talking about fact, they're not talking about history, they're talking about myth. So I think that the problem that you confront is symptomatic of how deeply self-delusioned not just students are, but we are as a culture. And we are self-delusioned because there are powerful forces of propaganda that work to keep us self-delusioned.
Hi, thank you. Just for all you do. And thank you for the JP Board for organizing the hardest job in the world. I was told that Toastmasters would be able to announce the past mass amendment statewide ballot initiative to amend the state constitution based on corporations are not people, money is not speech, sign up on the list, we're taking it to the streets, we're sick of waiting. And we want to hope you will join us in endorsing this effort, like Dr. Chomsky and Dr. McKibben. We are taking it to the streets, so thank you so much for what you do. And there's not really a question here exactly. Who do you endorse? Thank you.
I will endorse anything. Dystopia or totalitarian society in human history. We are able now to do, or our security and surveillance state is able to do things that the Stasi in East Germany didn't even dream of. And I think one of the things that's most disturbing to those of us who have been challenging for several years the security and surveillance apparatus is that we now have all of the information given to us by Snowden in terms of, you know, documents. And yet it is clear that neither the courts or elected officials are going to do a damn thing about it. The only hope that we have now to break the back of the security and surveillance apparatus, which, as I said at the beginning of the talk, when you are monitored 24 hours a day, that is the relationship of a master and a slave. You are not a free person. And as Hannah Arendt writes correctly, the purpose in totalitarian regimes to gather information is not to gather, is not to solve a crime. It's to gather, I use it in quotes, evidence. So that when you go to arrest a certain category of people, you have whatever it is. You know, whether it's actually criminal or not, it doesn't matter. You have the evidence by which to take them. And that's why everything is swept up and held. That's what Stalin did. That's what the Gestapo did. That's what the Stasi did. That is how totalitarian regime worked. And the only popular response has been in Germany, because I think that there is not only a historical understanding of what this means, but they're old enough to remember the East German Stasi state, but people haven't experienced it. So cyberpunks is quite a kind of frightening window into what will happen if there isn't reform. And it's now clear that even though all of this has been made public, and we are the most watched, monitored, photographed, profiled population in human history, we are sitting here like sheep. And we better respond now while there's still time. Because with both economic disintegration and the disintegration that is inevitable from climate change, they have done what all totalitarian systems do. They have put in place the mechanisms by which we can be in chain. And that's what makes this moment in history imperative and important for everybody in this room, that we get out and sacrifice, and not for ourselves, fine, but for those who come after us. I have 4 children, and I may fail, but at least I want my kids to look back and say, he tried. And that is what all of us are called upon to do. Thank you very much.